Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 136.
This week on the podcast, Obama establishes full diplomatic relations with Cuba, angering conservative Floridians everywhere. Because nothing says conceding to tyranny like diplomatic relations.
Governor Andrew Cuomo finally confirms what everyone with flammable drinking water has known for ages and bans fracking in New York.
And do you remember that movie that you weren't going to see with your family on Christmas, The Interview? Well, now you can carry on with that plan guilt-free after Sony pulls it over a possible North Korean terrorist threat.
New York Magazine follows in Rolling Stone's lazy footsteps by not checking any sources in their Stuyvesant students' fake $72 million stock market fortune story.
And seriously, Mitt Romney is still leading the Republican presidential polls? Well, thankfully, Donald Trump is looking to challenge him in a battle for the nomination and for the title of most out-of-touch, uber-rich old white man in America.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hi guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yes, and do it.
Do it, and you can find us on two different coasts, too, because
that's where
this is coming from.
It's one of our classic bi-coastal podcasts.
That's right. This is coming straight from the internet, in the most straight from the internet
sense. We're
looking
at each other on video chat.
That's right.
Lila's doing some holiday showering. Or some holiday traveling. Neither of us have showered, is what I was going to say. We look a mess today. So it's a good thing this is not a video.
Right. Anything. There's a reason that we don't do this as a video podcast. And it's
right. Yeah.
Because we're not
it's
doing
because
holiday
we usually
showering.
Are in our sweatpants, unshowered on a Saturday afternoon.
Sunday. But it's Sunday good afternoon. To know that Brent knows.
I don't even know what day it is.
No. How could you know? You're in a vacation haze.
I am. That's it. And yet I have to work on Monday and Tuesday, so I really need to pull my brain together.
Because get your shit
sorted out.
I'm
not on vacation yet.
Well, you probably are tired because this was a huge week.
Like, it was a huge week. A huge Wednesday, really, too.
A huge Wednesday. Wednesday was everything to everyone.
Just like a hump day that kept on giving.
That's right. We had huge announcements about a change in our relationship with Cuba, which was wonderful and exciting for me, and I guess everyone, but I have been sort of focused on this issue for a long time, so I felt especially gratified by the whole thing.
Right, this is like right in your wheelhouse here.
It's right in my wheelhouse.
As soon as I saw this, like, I was like, oh my god, what is Lila thinking about this right now?
I'm thinking a lot about the siren that's going by, but beyond the siren that's going by, I'm in New York. This is the sounds of New York.
I was going to say, well, we're not in our normal soundproof
studio exactly.
that we're in. Right.
Right. Yeah. But in any case, we had this big prisoner exchange with Cuba, which then sort of prompted us to make a bunch of announcements that are very exciting about the future of our relationship with Cuba. It began with, we had a prisoner exchange where we released an intelligence officer in exchange for three members, or they released an intelligence agent in exchange for three members of the Cuban Five. There's already two that are out of jail anyway. The Cuban Five are like major folk heroes back in Cuba. Like, that's a really big deal for Cuba.
Yeah.
Because this has been a major source of discussion within Cuba for years. I mean, I have been to Cuba several times. Every time I've been there, it's like all anyone's talked about. We've gone to events to support the Cuban Five and the Cuban Five. We've met the Cuban Five families. And, you know, everyone's been talking about the Cuban Five for years. So the fact that the Cuban Five are now all five out of jail is an enormous deal there. And I think, like, a sort of sign of goodwill from us to them, at least enough that we're going to sort of begin to have discussions with them. They released Alan Gross, who was one of those like USAID subcontractors who was like going in and trying to like foment change under the guise of humanitarian work. For USAID has been doing this.
I know. I said to you, I was like, I have never thought that we would be talking about USAID so much on this podcast. I didn't know what it was before this podcast, but like they have been up to like wacky shenanigans. Like, if you will remind you, like, they were the ones who started sort of like fake Twitter revolution down there, like the, you know, like, and they've been up to like all sorts of like weirdness. That's USAID. So we,
yeah, they will, and their director had to resign.
It's not surprising that there was a USAID contract down there who was imprisoned because they're up to some shenanigans down there.
He was apparently in very poor health. And a lot of politicians had been talking about how we might be willing to start opening relations with Cuba if they released him. Like, that was a big talking point for us.
Right.
So on Wednesday, Patrick Leahy, Jeff Flake, and Chris Van Hollen went down to Cuba and picked him up. on a plane with the three of them who like to talk about Cuba.
An odd collection of folks, but well, God bless them.
Jeff Flake is someone who I once even interviewed Jeff Flake for an article that I wrote for some magazine in Arizona about his support of ending the embargo with Cuba, because he's been a real proponent of that for a long time, and he's one of the only Republicans that is. And I think it's because he, you know, he represents the state that's like all lettuce growers, basically. Like his state, would stand a lot to, they have a lot to gain from opening relations with Cuba, because it's this huge market, and you know, he likes the market. He's into the market.
Sure.
So in any case, they went down, picked up Alan Gross. He was went back, got his photo taken with a bunch of people, smiled and things. The Cuban Five were released fully and are now in Cuba being celebrated as heroes, I'm sure. We also got this an intelligence agent who's interestingly like the person we know the least about in this scenario, because Alan Gross got all the press. So we don't really know like why this intelligence agent had been imprisoned by Cuba. He was a Cuban guy who was working for us, I think, and he had been in prison for like almost 2 decades. So we don't really know anything about what he was up to. But all of this was followed by a very exciting press conference where Obama and then Raul Castro also made a simultaneous announcement on Cuban television, basically said that we're going to start establish full diplomatic relations with Cuba now, which
I heard a story from the on NPR on their BBC report, and they have reporters there, obviously, and they were talking about like how basically, in Cuba and places like that, like when there's an announcement like this, everybody watches it basically.
Yeah.
But he was just sort of like talking about how pretty much, this probably went mostly unnoticed in America. Not really.
Wait,
every household was like, just enraptured by Raul Castro on Cuban TV, like hearing about this basically.
Well, this is the defining issue of their last, more than 50 years. I mean, this is all anyone talks about there. So this is huge news there. And, there's really only one source of news there. Like, the news sort of starts at the top. So when Raul Castro is speaking on television,
on TV.
Exactly. Yeah. That's something that you
watch. What else do they have to watch?
Well, not much. And also, I mean, this is how Fidel got away with making, tons of 3-hour speeches and 8-hour speeches. And, he was like Bill Clinton on steroids. Like, you know how Bill Clinton used to make those just like run-on 3-hour speeches where you'd be like, stop talking now. Like, it's too much.
Right.
Well, Fidel put him to shame regularly, making, 6-hour speeches, 8-hour speeches, and people were just watching that shit. I don't know. They love to hear a speech over there. So in any case,
they're like me.
Yeah, they're like Brent.
Brent and I,
the one thing we don't share is a love of speech listening, because Brent loves to hear a good speech, and I didn't have to watch the State of the Union for just like general, knowing things reasons, I would absolutely not do that, because I do not like listening to speeches.
I know. I'm already looking forward to the next one. It's coming up. It's in January.
I know. I'm looking forward to the day after that when I've already done it and don't have to do it for another year. So that's. But so in any case, we're going to be easing some of our restrictions about travel. You're still going to have licensed travel there, but it's not going to be, they're going to sort of expand the
it's not as if every situation. The embargo is just not all of a sudden sort of like over.
But there's little steps happening. Cuba's going to release 53 Cuban prisoners that are considered political prisoners by the U.S. We're going to put an embassy down there, which is a huge deal, because currently we just have this like weird like U.S. interests office that I'm not convinced has anyone in it. Obama did say that it is now time for Congress to really have a debate about lifting the embargo against Cuba, because it's not been working so well. And he's going to be easing certain elements of the blockade with executive authority, because actually, interestingly enough, this is a little history for everyone. The embargo was mostly maintained with executive authority until 1996. Bill Clinton had run on a platform of potentially doing something about this issue and easing these restrictions. Mm-hmm. And instead somehow got railroaded into passing the Helms-Burton Act, which basically codified this thing that had been executive authority. So Bill Clinton, like he did with healthcare reform, where he ran on doing that and then didn't accomplish that at all, but somehow it got worse after him.
A lot of fake support
coming
out of the Clinton White House.
Exactly. Like, Bill Clinton somehow managed to make this worse under his tenure. And so now it's an actual law instead of just like a thing that presidents have been maintaining out of tradition or whatever. So there's only so much that Obama can do with executive authority, but he's going to do what he can, I guess. And they're going to start having diplomatic talks, which will be fun. And, you know, they're going to start working together on drugs and environment issues and human trafficking and that sort of thing. So I would still recommend that if you're planning to go to Cuba, go there before tourism becomes legal, because it's going to be a very different place after that, probably. As it is now, there are 12 categories that you can currently go on licensed trips under. And a lot of them are like family visits. And if you're a journalist or if you're going to do like cultural exchange, go on one of those trips before the actual tourism kicks in. Because
And I are looking at one.
We're going to go look.
But I want to go.
No, of course. Yeah. No, you want to go. And also, once you're there, you still get to do a beach day, and the beaches are beautiful. So, like, don't worry about that. But I'm just saying, try to go before. It's a more interesting place than I think it will become once it's overrun with American corporations. Although they've done a good job of limiting the footprint of European corporations and things like that. They insist they
still have
some agency
as a communist nation, they can sort of just decide to keep all those things out.
Right. Well, and they have allowed like private investment, but they maintain a state controlling interest in anything that comes in as a private. It's always private public partnerships. It's not like they just allow private companies to come
in. Right. Well, and that's what a lot of people were talking this week, sort of like, because we just sort of like, as a nation, don't talk about Cuba much anyway, just sort of, you know, like as a country. So I think it's been interesting to hear a lot this week, just sort of like, just hearing about Cuba, basically, because I mean, I think so many people, because of this embargo and because it's been going on for so long, have sort of like really, you know, insane notions about what's going on down there. And like, yes, some of them probably at least at one point were like, you know, founded in facts. But I mean, like, you know, supposedly, you know, the small business climate is really good there. And yes, it's all public and private partnerships. But I mean, like, it's not, you know, they're not up to North Korea shenanigans down there.
No, well, and also Raul Castro has made huge changes to, and in terms of easing a lot of these restrictions. So it used to be that it was not even possible to have like a small private business there. And now there's huge numbers of small private businesses in Cuba.
Right.
The economy there is changing really fast. And also, I think they're gonna start having banking ties with Cuba so that you can finally use your debit card there. Because one thing that's really annoying about going to Cuba is having to carry huge quantities of cash with you everywhere. That's a frustrating thing that nobody enjoys doing. Like, I remember the first time I went there, I was 16. And so it was like one of the first trips that I had taken. It was definitely the first trip I had taken by myself, like without my parents, into the developing world. And one of the first trips I had taken without like an enormous group and like an adult in charge. And me and my friend who went, like, we were like not really sure what we were supposed to do with all these like thousands of dollars we'd had to carry with us in cash. And so we were wearing like money belts, and we had some in our bras, and we had some in our boots, and we're like walking around with like hundreds of dollars on us at all times, like spread out throughout our body. Like, we actually went and bought those bras that have like a little slot for like a push-up thing. In them, and took the push-up cushions out and like put money in them. that is something that we did.
Well, you were resourceful.
We were resourceful. We didn't know what to do. It was a lot of money at stake. And also, once you run out of cash, you're just out. Like, you can't go to the bank there. So we didn't really know what to do. So in any case.
You got to be well prepared in Cuba.
Yeah, you got to be well prepared. Exactly. And then also what is exciting, I guess, for people who like to pollute the environment with their dumb smoke is that you can now bring $400 worth of, or you can now bring $100 in tobacco and alcohol products and $400 worth of goods. You used to be able to bring a certain amount if you went on a licensed trip, and then they kind of cut that out, and then they sort of, you know, now they're expanding that a little bit. So now
cigar lovers everywhere are
very excited about this. I'm less excited because I hate the smell of cigar smoke, and now people are just going to be trying to pretend like, oh, can you smell the beauty of this Cuban cigar, and I'm going to be like, no.
No, you can't. It smells like smoke.
But in any case, that's what's been going on the Cuba end. That issue had been picking up steam anyway. Hillary Clinton had even gone on the record saying that it was time for the embargo to end. She wrote about it in Hard Choices, a book that she didn't actually write. She had said before that she
had that sitting on my shelf for months.
Yeah, well,
you don't need to
read it. She didn't write it.
Right. It's one of those books where I'm like, God, I guess maybe I should read that, even though I don't like her. But like, I just can't. It's too daunting. It's too big. I'm looking at it right now. It's gigantic.
Well, this is another area where you and I differ, I think, because I don't feel any inclination whatsoever to read any of these political books, and you always like to read
them. I like to read those books.
I know. I think it's sort of like listening to them speak for, like, hours and hours and hours on end.
Well, it is. It would be like listening to them speak for months on end.
Months on end.
As slow as I read.
Exactly.
I'd have Hillary Clinton in my ear until 2016. And I'm already going to have her in my ear until 2016.
No,
probably,
she's going to be talking. You're going to be having her all over.
I don't need her actual human voice and her written word voice both going at the same time.
No, it's too much. It's too much, Hillary.
It's too much. Much too much.
But, I mean, this is an interesting, I mean, this is, I guess, an issue she can step out on as someone who had initially been against the embargo, but considering that she was basically part of the administration that, like, codified it, it's an interesting thing for her.
Right. Except I think that she's trying to, like, not step out on any issue that she agrees with Obama on right now, because, like, I think that she sees that as toxic.
I think, maybe gonna learn the hard way that that's maybe not her greatest plan ever, because it's going to make her seem like a raving Republican. And there were some raving Republicans that were very angry about this Cuba news. Interestingly enough, because a lot of these are Florida politicians who came out against this, and that's not surprising. But it is, I want to remind everyone that Charlie Crist ran on an anti-embargo platform for governor, and though he did not win, he came in very close in that race. That was not an issue that destroyed his ambitions. Him being an idiot destroyed his ambitions, because he's a Republican who was running as a Democrat.
I was going to say, that
destroyed his ambitions.
Rick Scott without a party.
Being a bigger idiot than him destroyed his ambitions, because people in Florida seem to like that. But it wasn't like this was greeted with that much controversy. It really wasn't that big of a deal there. So I think there's been some transition, which is why it's so interesting to see that Marco Rubio is just, like, losing his mind over this.
Oh, my God. He, like, just went off. And I saw him on Meet the Press this morning, and that's when I texted you. I texted Lyle this morning, and I said, Marco Rubio is an idiot, but not just sort of like, oh, that guy's an idiot, but like an actual real-life stupid person.
I'm not surprised.
He's a real idiot.
A real one.
Because he was saying some, like, just real wingnutty stuff about this. He said it was a concession to tyranny, and also just, like, talked about, like, how it showed Obama's, you know, sort of, like, stupidity to how the world works, naivety about, like, how the world works, and it was like, okay, guy.
Yeah. Like, no, and before that appearance, he had called Obama willfully ignorant.
Yes, like, yes.
Like, come on, Marco Rubio. I get that you represent Florida, and you are also a Cuban person yourself, and that is where this is all coming from, but, like, recognize that, like, this is not the way the wind is blowing. Interestingly enough, another person who did not recognize that this is where the way the wind is blowing is Bob Menendez, who is a Democrat.
Right.
And he's the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, so that's maybe a problem for everyone. He's not anymore, I guess. He's not about to be the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. But he is also, he's another Cuban, or a child of Cuban parents. He said, let's be clear, this was not a humanitarian act by the Castro regime. It was a swap of convicted spies for an innocent American. I think we've proven that USAID's activities were not always strictly innocent. I'm just going to say, as much as I don't think he should have been imprisoned, I also don't necessarily think that we can pretend like USAID was up to only good humanitarian things, but the Cuban Five were somehow up to shenanigans. Like, let's be honest about what was going on.
We brought you at least three stories telling you otherwise.
Yeah. Well, and the head of USAID has had to resign recently over all of these stories. I mean, this has been a big problem for them. So, in any case, he went on to say, President Obama's actions have vindicated the brutal behavior of the Cuban government. Like, stop yourself right now. And then Jeb Bush couldn't resist getting in on the fun. He said, I don't think we should be negotiating with a repressive regime to make changes in our relations with them until there are substantive changes on the island. But then, a few weeks ago, he had already said that the current prohibitions are too loose and that the U.S. government should clamp down harder on the Castro regime. He said, I would argue that instead of lifting the embargo, we should consider strengthening it again to put pressure on the Cuban regime, because that's worked so well in the past.
I was going to say, I mean, really? That's your plan?
Yeah, he doesn't have much of a great plan. But he was all, he said this to anyone who would listen. I mean, he would put it on Facebook, and he was talking to the Miami Herald about it, and he'd been talking about it for a while. So, you know, this is...
Oh, yeah, he was giving speeches at the U.S.-Cuba Democracy Pact
Yeah.
Earlier this month, which favors maintaining the embargo. I mean, like, it's apparently a real issue for him.
Real issue.
Yeah.
So, in any case, the other big win on Wednesday was a win in New York State, where the Cuomo administration announced that it was going to ban fracking in New York State, which is a huge deal.
Right. Right. Well, and these were – the exciting thing about Wednesday is that we sort of, like, got to just, like, almost wake up to these things, at least here in California. And it was like neither of them were things that anybody really saw coming, even though maybe, you know, you could have, I guess, maybe, but not really, I don't think. I mean, it was – they were both just sort of, like, announcements, and you were like, oh, my God, this is all – it was all happening at once.
Yeah. No, it was – this was a big deal because I certainly didn't expect to hear an announcement on fracking – that Wednesday. And then there was, so basically there was like this year-end cabinet meeting that Cuomo convened. Right. He had been putting off making a decision about this for years. So there was really no end in sight as far as the decision was going. He had been constantly talking about this study that they were supposedly doing into the health effects of fracking or the environmental effects of fracking. And the study results just like never came. Like they just, it went on forever.
And that's the, this is a classic move, like, whenever there's an issue kind of like this, either environmental or, like...
It's like Keystone.
You know, I mean, Obama's doing the same thing on the Keystone Pipeline right now, sort of like is, you know, waiting for all the facts to come in or whatever. Now, I'm glad he's pushing that off because I think that he's ultimately going to say no on that. But anyway, I mean, I think that, like, it's just whenever you don't want to make a decision like this, you sort of, like, point to, you know... waiting on some sort of report or trying to get all the facts or whatever. And it's just sort of like, okay, I think we can all decide that you don't need any more facts on fracking. Like, let's just...
We know exactly what's going on with fracking. It's no good.
We know what's going on.
It's no good.
It's not good. Yeah.
But so the state health commissioner, Howard Zucker, had finally came through with these results and said that he wouldn't want to live in a community with fracking. He was like, you know, as I considered what kind of advice to give on this, I realized that, like, I would never want to live in a community with fracking. So, like, of course it's not a good thing for people.
Right.
So, in any case, this is huge news for people who live on the Marcellus Shale because it means that all of these small issues...
Right, I was going to say, and the reason this is big news is, because there's a lot of fracking going on in New York State. I mean, this isn't just some sort of...
There's not a lot of fracking going on in New York State. There is a lot of potential fracking going on in New York
State. There's a lot of potential fracking,
right? There's not a lot of fracking going on.
There could be...
There's a lot of fracking going on.
Right, because they sort of have a limited ban going right now.
There was a moratorium on fracking.
People trying to get in on the fracking game, and there's a lot of potential for fracking.
Exactly.
This is big news.
Yeah. There had been a lot of fracking in Pennsylvania, which is bordering New York State.
Right.
And that is where there was already sort of environmental damage being done to New York State by that that happening. And so Cuomo had put a moratorium on fracking in place years ago, and then but everyone was sort of waiting with bated breath to see how this would all play out because it also seemed like he might kowtow to the interests of these corporations that do the fracking.
And that's what everybody was that's what everybody was fearful of. And it was also, I think, part of the reason why people were fearful of it is because it was weird that he didn't do this during his primary.
Yeah.
Because he would have, I mean, he won by a fair margin anyway, but a lot of people felt like it was embarrassing enough, that primary for him, that maybe people were talking about that was embarrassing enough that he maybe couldn't even run for president.
Well,
and the reason that Zephyr Teachout did so well is because she was basically running on an anti-fracking campaign.
She
and it's like, if he would have just done this
in upstate New York.
Right. If he would have done this in, you know, October, then, or whenever that was, this summer, I can't remember when his primary was. I mean, he just won re-election. But if he would have done that, you know, a few months ago, there would have been no sort of like embarrassment for him having this like close primary because
I think that they were very much in the dark about how much anger there was over that issue in upstate New York, especially because upstate is much more conservative and there's very big pro fracking contingents in upstate New York as well because there's a lot of people who like are in struggling farms and don't really have any way of, you know, figuring out, can't figure out how to make a living up there. So I think it was actually pretty shocking to everyone that Zephyr Teachout did as well as she did in a lot of those places because no one had really checked to find out whether there was this much anger over fracking, at least among Democratic voters. And there was a lot of it.
Right.
She delivered massive numbers in a lot of the communities along the Marcellus Shale, like massive, like really surprisingly, like it was taking away over 70% of the vote in some of those counties, which is huge. And A neighbor from our town in upstate New York, Yoko Ono, is one of the people who helped sort of bring awareness to this issue. She got
you
a special
see her just like
shout out
bopping
around in the Times article about it. And she was one of the she was against it because it was getting discussed in the community that, you know, my family has a house up there, and then also that my, you know, grandparents and extended family had lived in. So it was big deal.
You ever run into her? Just
never run into her. Never once. No, you know, I think I don't know that she actually goes up there. Like, I don't know what no one actually knows if she's ever up there. I feel like it's just a place
that woman of mystery.
It's a woman of mystery. I don't actually know how close she lives. Everyone just talks about it. Like, no one knows how close she actually lives to anyone or if she's even up there. Nobody knows anything.
Right. She's like a mythical creature up there.
Yeah. She's like a mythical creature. Exactly.
Yeah. She's like upstate New York's Bigfoot.
Yeah. Right. Well, and it's just like, you know, like upstate New York, I feel like gets a bad rap because it's not as pretty as a lot of the like New England states that border it. So it's just sort of like, it's just like this giant place that they were planning to like start fracking in. They're trying to build a pipeline up there. Like, they're trying to destroy it actively and have been for years. So like, no one is paying attention to it. Because it used to, you know, it's like so much of it was, you know, so much of it was like on the Erie Canal and like kind of associated with like terrible industrial, like horrible places. So like, no one knows what the rest of New York State is like anyway. It could be, anything could be going on up there. Meanwhile, speaking of places that anything could be going on, North Korea is one of those places. And we now apparently, and I'm refusing to eat my words on this because I still think that there are more revelations to come. But apparently the Justice Department, the Justice Department is involved in this. I think it was the FBI who are now saying that North Korea is responsible for the Sony hack.
Right. And
because of that,
there are still some people who are sort of, the evidence is sketchy. It's all sort of like ties to the North Korean government. It wasn't happening in North Korea. North Korea is claiming that they didn't do it, which I guess maybe is what you would do. But I mean, it's a little, you know, I was watching Meet the Press this morning and Bill Richardson was on, who has been to North Korea, and that was sort of like a pet issue of his has been sort of like North Korea things. And he was real hesitant to believe it. He basically said that he was buying the evidence and sort of like, I think he probably was just like, didn't want to say that he didn't believe the FBI, like as a person who has, you know, worked in government. But I mean, like, even he was sort of like, I didn't believe it initially, and sort of sounded like he wanted to say that he still didn't believe it, but wasn't going that far.
Sorry, if you can hear banging on my end, I have a small child that lives in the apartment next door to us, and she is making a lot of noise. I don't think it was registering, but all of a sudden, I think it started to register. So I just needed to point that out. I think,
you know, this is what happens when we have bi-coastal podcasts.
These are the bi-coastal podcasts, exactly.
That's right.
Brent is going to tell you about how Sony stopped the interview's release over all of this while I moved to a different room.
All right. Well, here's what happened. Lila just told us. They're not releasing it. But they've been getting a lot of blowback about this because they basically came... What happened was there were threats of terrorist attacks on movie chains that were going to be showing the film. So what happened was a lot of the major theater chains decided that they were not going to show the movie at all. So that is really sort of the ultimate reason why Sony decided not to release it, or at least that's what they're claiming anyway, because of course everybody got immediately angry with Sony that they were sort of, you know, gave in to the demands of North Korea or the terrorists or whoever it was that had hacked them. So they obviously came out hard against that and said it wasn't that we pulled it because of, you know, us giving in to their demands. It was because none of the theater chains were going to show it anyway, so releasing it was sort of, you know, what was releasing it going to do anyway? I think a lot of people are angry that at least as of now, they have no plans to release it online. Because, Right, because if your fear is that, you know, there's going to be an attack on a movie theater that's playing it, then, you know, release it online.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Even Mitt Romney this week had like a ridiculous tweet where he was like, release it online and have people pay $5 and give it to the Ebola response, which I didn't quite get, but like that was his master plan.
Thanks, Mitt.
I don't know.
Thanks a lot.
Anyway.
You're a helpful guy.
So, but like a lot of, obviously, you know, this has people are angry about this because it sort of, you know, even Obama was angry about it because basically, you know, what it boils down to is that everybody is sort of like, well, we can't have, you know, insane dictatorships from across the world, you know, dictating what movies we can and can't see. You know, a lot of people felt like it was censorship that, you know, was being imposed by North Korea. And even Obama was mad at this. He was like, they shouldn't have done it. I wish they would have talked to me. He said that Americans should be going to the movie theater and not be scared.
Right, and he's so even Sony he is said taking that to them after they had made all those terribly racially insensitive remarks about him in their emails that got released.
I know, right? Yeah,
it was like they no wonder they didn't talk to you
because they were too scared to talk to him.
Exactly, they were a little embarrassed to be talking to you.
Right.
Yeah, but it was definitely, you know, they showed it at my office on Monday before this all came out, and I didn't go to see it. Because
yeah.
I was like, nah.
Well,
I
know a lot of people have seen
it.
I mean, it's been seen, and there are clips being released, sort of it. And you know, that's the thing about Los Angeles. Like, you know, you sort of everybody's got a screener of everything, or is going to pre screenings of things. So it's you know, I've seen people on my Facebook wall talking about like, oh, so glad I got to see the interview, you know, before it got pulled. But
it will get out. And I mean, I think this was a little, I feel like the other thing is that even if those five movie chains had not been willing to show the movie, like, there would have been so much demand to see it that somebody would have made a
chance. Well, that's the thing. I mean, this is, you know, it's one of those things where it's sort of like, you know, all press is good press or whatever the sort of old adage is, because it's like, this was not going to be, I mean, this probably would have, like, done okay as maybe, like, some Christmas counter-programming, and people love, you know, James Franco and Seth Rogen,
but it wouldn't have been.
It wasn't going to be like a massive hit. I mean, everybody's going to see like Into the Woods and Unbroken and whatever else they're going to see on Christmas. They're not going to see The Interview. I mean, it's sort of like it was just going to be sort of like a fun comedy, you know, counter viewing, you know, Christmas programming. It wasn't going to make $100 million. It may have ended up making $100 million after all of this had they decided to release it, because everybody would have tried to go.
Could have had a $100 million movie on their hands.
So
here we are. No $100 million for them. Yeah. Well, the Sony has mishandled this on every level in every way. So
well, they have mishandled it because a lot of people are upset with them anyway, because like I think they started getting a little worried about this before even any of this started happening, because now there have been reports this week that they took the ending of the film to someone in the State Department to sort of like have them.
Right. Well, there was already controversy like about the film before it came out. So.
Right. So, and that is like another thing that sort of, you know, a lot of people who sort of, you know, don't want this, you know, who are concerned about censorship, they were pissed that Sony would even think to do that anyway, because like, you know, on some level, like, why do you think that you need to be showing your movie to the government to like get, oh, you know, the okay to like put it into theaters, because that's, you know, you shouldn't have to be showing something like that like creatively to someone in the State Department to like, you know, get sign off on. I mean, that in and of itself is sort of
problematic.
You know, problematic. Yeah, exactly.
Say the least. Meanwhile, big news in New York City this weekend, because there was this like kind of gruesome murder of two policemen in Bed-Stuy. This guy who had come from Baltimore, and the Baltimore police sent a warning to the NYPD that this guy was a threat, because he has a long rap sheet, and he has already thought to have shot his former girlfriend in Baltimore, and he's, you know, convicted of robbery and carrying a concealed gun. But he'd been making social media statements about wanting to kill police officers because of the Eric Garner and Michael Brown cases.
He went to New York from Baltimore basically vowing to do this.
With this plan in mind, and he had announced it on Facebook. But the Baltimore police sent that warning like basically as he was committing this crime, where he just went up to this car, this patrol car, with two officers in Bed-Stuy and shot them both point blank. And it has ignited like a really weird situation in New York. Because as much as in general instances of violence like this are actually way down in New York right now, because de Blasio had sort of asked the police to respect the rights of these protesters in the, you know, in the aftermath of the Eric Garner situation. Now for some, like a bunch of rank and file police officers, turned their backs to him at the press conference. And that wasn't just him, by the way, Their boss, Bill Bratton, was standing up there as well. So they turned their backs to, like, the entire administration. And then the head of the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, Patrick Lynch, delivered this crazy speech where he...
This is
outside the hospital at the press conference. Like, the families are there. Like, they are there to speak about the sort of well-being of... Or the non-well-being, I guess. But they're there to speak about the deaths of these two police officers. The mayor is there. Bill Bratton is there. Everyone is there. And he said... There's blood on many hands tonight. Those that incited violence on the street under the guise of protests, that tried to tear down what New York City police officers did every day, that blood's on the hands starts at the steps of City Hall in the office of the mayor, which is, I mean, a really dangerous comment to be making about the mayor.
It really is.
Especially because
this
was an act of random violence. This wasn't like protesters.
Well, and that's the other thing. It's also just totally ridiculous. I mean... The fact that, you know, one crazy person with a gun did this shouldn't have anything to do with the fact that de Blasio wanted there to be peaceful protests without the police
and
being involved.
And P.S., those protests have been
New York
almost
City.
Historically peaceful. Without the antagonism of the police,
exactly.
The protesters, there have been very few arrests at those protests. So,
right.
Well, it's been working.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's just totally a ridiculous notion to think that the mayor is even remotely responsible for this.
No.
I mean, this is one
but this is,
insane person.
Right, and this is, I mean, but this is problematic in the sense that Patrick Lynch made this comment, but then that plus these officers turning their backs, I mean, I don't know, this is sort of points to something problematic about the culture of the NYPD at the moment, which only really strengthens the argument of the protesters in a lot of ways.
Well, right, I mean... I agree. Was anyone sort of talking about, you know, there being blood on the hands of the police officers who killed Eric Gardner? I mean, you know,
Because
this killing was to do. I mean, the guy who shot these two police officers did claim that it was sort of like in response to, you know, police killing, you know, Eric Gardner. Where was their outrage, you know, in regards to that?
No, exactly. I think, you know, this is maybe going to be, I think, one of the big challenges of de Blasio's administration, but this is also one of the things he was elected to do, was change the culture of the NYPD. We had been living with, like, 12 years of totalitarian crazy rule, you know, or not, 16 years of that. I mean, you know, Giuliani...
Yeah.
Changed the culture of the police in his own way by making them into sort of like martial law style crazy people. And Bloomberg strengthened it to the degree that only rich white people could really expect fair treatment from them. So this is a shift that New Yorkers are looking for already. And these guys have just proven that it's necessary. So it's a little concerning and a little problematic. And it's going to be a challenging period in New York City for the next few weeks while this gets sorted out. And if I were anybody, I would find a new head of the Patrolman's Benevolent Association real fast, because this guy sounds like a hot-headed prick.
Yeah, and while you're absolutely right that this is going to be a challenge, any challenge like this is also an opportunity to, you know, to get this figured out. And I think de Blasio is obviously the person
interestingly,
you would want to be sort of trying to get this figured out. I mean,
Giuliani... came out and said that it was inappropriate to blame the mayor for this. He also said that it was Obama's fault, which was sort of a curious thing.
That's
but he did come out and say that it was not appropriate for them to lay this at de Blasio's feet. So that was interesting. I don't know how helpful it was, but it was interesting. Meanwhile, speaking of grossly overstepping the bounds of the law, Hillary Clinton finally commented on the Senate torture report that we talked about ad nauseum last week.
Oh, boy.
While getting the Ripple of Hope Award at a human rights dinner honoring Robert Kennedy. So that's something, I guess. That's a real award that people are winning, the Ripple of Hope Award. So if you were curious about that, now you know. She was really on a real roll. She had a lot of thoughts about, you know, things, about issues of the day. She talked a little bit about the recent attacks in Sydney and in Pakistan, and said that he sort of related those to us condoning torture, saying that we really shouldn't sort of we shouldn't, you know, engage in that kind of behavior. We shouldn't condone torture anywhere. And if that requires new legislation, then Congress and Obama should get that done. It shouldn't be like a partisan thing. She quoted her BFF John McCain. So that was fun for her because, I mean, he's a big anti-torture proponent, but also he's a BFF of the Clintons and a crazy person. So they love to talk with him about these things, I'm sure. She also went, she also referenced these Ferguson and Eric Garner protests, interestingly, and said that part of RFK's legacy is a responsibility to address some of these social issues, and said, we can stand up together and say, yes, Black Lives Matter. Yes, the government should serve and protect all our people. Yes, our country is strongest when everyone has a fair shot at the American dream. That inequality is not inevitable. That some of the social disparities we see today may stem from the legacies of segregation and discrimination, but we don't have to perpetuate them. It's interesting that she thinks inequality is not inevitable. As a big proponent of banks and other places right. that make inequality inevitable.
This is what you have to say when you're getting something sort of like honoring RFK's legacy.
Right. You have to pretend that you believe that inequality isn't inevitable. I mean, it's not. Exactly. It's just, it's the result of processes that she's participating in. So it's not inevitable. Yeah, it's her fault, but it's not inevitable.
One thing, you know, she talked about a lot of issues in, you know, of the day here. But one thing that I was reading about this week, which I thought was interesting, and we sort of referenced it last week because we were talking about, you know, in regards to Elizabeth Warren really coming out against the, you know, the Wall Street giveaways in the new spending bill. She has been totally mum on what she thinks about the spending bill.
Yes.
And a lot of her close allies are sort of will secretly tell you it's because she wasn't really that mad about it.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
So I found that very interesting because that was obviously like the big news of last week that we heard nothing from her on, which is interesting of someone who is probably going to be running for president to sort of stay so mum on that. But it was probably because she was going to piss off all of the Democrats who were, like, at the time really loving on Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah. I'm not as shocked to hear that as I would like to have been to hear that. I'd like to be really shocked to hear it, but here I am, not that shocked.
No, but if you were shocked, it would just mean that you haven't been paying attention for, like, the last two decades.
Right, exactly.
Fair enough. Which I know is not the case.
Meanwhile, her support amongst Democrats is slipping a little. So her inevitability quotient is going down. It's still way too high. But I feel like this is the beginning of the end of being inevitable. She was at one point because there was no one else in the pool. So like, why wouldn't she be inevitable? She's the only person anyone thought was running for president.
Yeah, exactly. So ABC released their new poll of sort of, you know, support for all the candidates for both Democrats and Republicans. And they've been doing this poll since last January, so almost a year, basically. And they have her support at 61%, which is still, nobody's even
in that
realm, obviously. But in January, when they first started doing it, it was at 73%. So it's gone down by 12% over the last year. And Joe Biden is the closest person at 14%, but right behind Joe Biden
is our
friend Elizabeth Warren, who enters into this poll for the first time in double digits at 13%.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, when you have these polls that are at least so early in the game and no one has declared, a lot of times they're really just sort of like about name recognition. So I think it's huge that she's almost behind the vice president at this point. I mean, she's basically tied with the vice president. And she claims to not be running. But I mean, just the fact that I think that we're sort of like starting to hear her name in a way that like is newsworthy and everybody talking about how much they love her. I mean, that's what we're looking for right now.
Yeah.
And she's been getting some huge pick-me-ups recently because we talked last week about MoveOn giving $1 million and setting up some offices in Iowa and New Hampshire. And this week, Democracy for America, which interestingly is what used to be Dean for America, DFA, when Howard Dean was running for president. And he wrote an op-ed last week for his support for Hillary Clinton, which is annoying to me because I like Howard Dean. But regardless, he's a bit of a budget hawk, so it doesn't surprise me, I guess, on some level that he is supporting her. But anyway, regardless, that's not the point. They are also, DFA, is giving $250,000 to this same, you know, campaign that's going on, and they all had a big rally in Iowa last week. So she got like $1.25 million dedicated to like just drafting her to run. She's not even running yet.
Yeah, no, this is big times for. She's being drafted. I think even Democracy for America probably knows that Hillary Clinton's victory, if they believe it to be an inevitable victory, is meaningless if no one runs against her and there's no debate, you know, that sort of drags her towards where the party actually stands. Because the thing about having the primary, which we always say, is that, like, if you have the primary, then people, then you get to take the temperature of the voters that are in your camp already. Like, you can't do that if you just run in a vacuum and then get to the general and think, well, I've got to really just sort of mitigate all my views to make them kind of generic and, you know, moderate, because otherwise no one will vote for me. And you don't even know where your base is at that. Like, that doesn't help anyone.
No.
You have to know where your base is.
And interestingly, just real quick with the Republicans, Mitt Romney still leading.
That's
potential Republican candidates.
Not a good sign for anyone. I know.
No. And he's just barely beating Jeb Bush, who pretty much announced that he was running this week. He announced that he was, like, seriously
exploring.
He announced
his exploratory committee. And you don't explore your options if you're not planning on having...
No one has ever said that they were exploring a presidential run and then later said, you know what, I don't think I'm going to do this.
Right. No, that doesn't happen. No, you explore it up until the point where it looks like it's not going to work for you. And then you're like, oh, I guess I'll drop out.
Right.
But that point is usually well into primary season. So that's...
Right. Yeah.
Meanwhile...
So he's running.
This has been a bad sort of last month for journalistic integrity and other things.
It sure has.
New York Magazine had this, like, major flub. And the reason it's of interest to us is because it involved my high school. But the reason it was of interest to America was because it involved this fantastical story of this senior at Stuyvesant named Muhammad Islam, who apparently had made $72 million investing in the stock market.
Oh, my gosh.
And they put it, New York Magazine put it on their list of, like, 100 reasons to love New York or 10 reasons. To, you know, they're always having lists about reasons you should love New York.
Well, everybody loves a list.
But they oddly just, like, had this specific number of $72 million. And this was, like, all over the news for, like, a day. And then the New York Post even wrote a story about it saying that, you know, also quoting the $72 million figure and saying that, you know, they're all making the joke that his hedge fund was going to open as soon as he turned 18, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Turns out the whole thing was a hoax, shockingly enough. First of all, even if you just try to do the math there, there's no way that you make $72 million without starting with, like, you know, $1 million or say, like, you don't make, much money without having a lot of money.
You see people posting, like, ridiculous things that are, like, on Facebook. And, like, I always say to people, like, if it sounds too fantastical to you, then do some research.
It might be.
And this is one of those things where it's like, does $72 million sound like a lot of money for someone to have quickly made in the stock market?
The thing,
like,
though,
where's the follow-up on this?
Who understands the stock market? A, nobody. And B, every person from Stuyvesant who posted it was like, God, anything is possible with Stuyvesant people, because you're regularly hearing stories of, like, Stuyvesant people doing stuff that you're like, how is that even a thing? So, like, I feel like I read this and I was like, yeah, of course, some Stuy kid made $72 million in the stock market, whatever.
Right.
Like, it didn't even, like, faze me to think about it. And because I have no understanding of how the stock market works, I was like, well, that sounds like a lot, but probably doable, right? It's gambling. Like,
right, yeah.
It didn't even sound crazy to me. And then...
Right. You can win any amount of money when you're gambling.
Exactly. I feel like any number that you tell me means the same thing. If they told me he had made $1 million, I would have been like, wow, a Stuyvesant kid making $1 million. And that was the exact reaction I had to $72 million. In any case... it turns out the whole thing, Muhammad Islam was running a club at Stuyvesant that was like a stock market club. And they were they were doing, like, sort of fake, you know, investments where they were,
they were playing,
doing
Monopoly,
simulated
basically.
Trades basically. You know? And he had a portfolio that was performing pretty well of simulated trades of fake money. Somehow this turned into a rumor that got the attention of New York Magazine, and he kind of, like, played along, oddly, and his friend Demir also played along. And no one knows where they got the $72 million figure in the New York Magazine story from, but it was, like, a rumor that was floating around that he wasn't denying. And then last week, after the whole
He never confirmed the $72 million.
He never confirmed the number, but he also he knew there was a rumor that involved an oddly specific sum, and he never denied it either. And then... they suddenly decided to announce that they literally came straight from a CNBC interview then went to the, like, they hired, like, a crisis PR firm, like a big crisis PR firm too, and then like came clean from the offices of this PR firm. Like, first of all, where are they getting the money to hire these crisis PR people? Like,
it's their fake money.
So many questions. Yeah, like they admitted that none of it was real money. So like, where is this crisis PR firm coming from? Do they sense that there are future opportunities? Are they like agents, sort of? The crisis PR people.
Well,
are like,
I was going to say,
appearances.
If you can make $72 million worth of fake simulated stock market money, then you can probably make a pretty decent amount of real stock market
but
money.
But his simulated trades were nowhere near that sum. That was what we did find out. Like, the $72 million figure had nothing to do with anything. It was just like a number that someone pulled out of a hat. Like, it wasn't like it wasn't like his actual simulated trades performed better than the market, but they didn't perform that well. And they were fake money. So that was a problem also. Also, I would argue that anyone who's doing well in the stock market is riding a wave of good luck that could run out at any moment. You can't know.
Well, you can't.
We have a mutual friend that's posting stock advice on Facebook to the degree that we've both had to unfriend him.
Not a mutual friend any longer, because we both...
No, exactly.
Or did you? I did.
I unfollowed him, and then he kept appearing... My instant messenger thing has, like, a news feed, and it includes people I've unfollowed for some reason. It includes, like... It's sort of like a raw feed of anything that's going on Facebook. So I found... I thought I had unfriended him, and I found that I had actually only unfollowed him. So I think I've unfriended him now.
That's just, like, the douchiest thing to be posting on Facebook.
It was the worst. And I didn't understand a word of it, so that was a more annoying thing, is I like to know everything, and I don't like it when you... post something that is deliberately designed for me to not know what you're talking about. Infuriating. Meanwhile, Ted Cruz's grand plan to block Obama's immigration executive orders backfired in the way that we told you it would. And Vivek Murthy is going to be the Surgeon General. So
we have a Surgeon General
we
now.
We did it, guys.
Hooray.
We finally have one.
Thank you, Ted Cruz.
Yay.
We talked last week about how the fact that Ted Cruz like kept everybody... over the weekend last week, which just pissed them off anyway.
Nobody likes to work on the weekend.
Nobody likes to work on the weekend. But it also pissed them off because it allowed Harry Reid to bring up a bunch of Obama nominees that the Republicans had been stalling for a long time, and they were trying to stall just until they sort of like took back over the Senate. Vivek Murthy was one of them, who Obama nominated 13 months ago.
Yes.
You know, we sort of realized we didn't have a Surgeon General during the whole Ebola crisis because a lot of people didn't know.
But
well,
we re-realized it. I assume at one point we knew, and then we unknew it because we assumed no one would ever pass any sort of confirmation process. So,
right, exactly.
We moved
and the reason that they had been stalling him is not because he was just like someone who was unqualified, because he was totally qualified. He was roundly supported when Obama nominated him. He was nominated by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, the American Cancer Society. I mean, basically everybody felt like he was a good nominee until the NRA dug up this tweet that he had tweeted where he said that gun violence was a public health crisis.
Yeah.
And so then, or I think he actually said guns specifically. I think he said guns are a public health crisis. So then, all Republicans and some wing nutty Democrats like all got on board to sort of like stall this nomination and not bring him up for a vote because they were kowtowing to the NRA. So that's why we've not had a Surgeon General for 13 months.
Yeah.
Is because of the NRA. But because Ted Cruz saved the day for us and allowed Harry Reid to bring him up for a vote, he got a vote on Monday, passed. 51-43. You don't have to have 60 votes for these nominees any longer.
Right.
So we have a Surgeon General now.
We did it. We made it happen.
We did
all
it.
Because Ted
Which
Cruz
great,
wanted
because...
to have a meaningless symbolic vote to get, you know, to stop Obama's immigration executive order from going through.
Yeah. Well, and the Surgeon General is sort of like the type of job that like you don't need a Surgeon General until you need a Surgeon General.
Right. Once there's
and
a major public health crisis.
Right. And we just recently realized that we needed one because... You know, he's the nation's doctor. And it would have been nice to have a doctor tell us how to properly respond to the Ebola crisis. And we didn't have that. We just had crazy people telling us how to respond to the Ebola crisis.
Yeah. That was the time that we needed a Surgeon General. And it was a time... And this, by the way, is all... Because this part of filibuster reform back when they did it in the most ineffective way possible years ago was that they were going to get these appointments through faster. So... The reason you don't need a supermajority to get this appointment through is because of that change that they made, you know, a couple years ago when Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell made that filibuster reform change.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be the only benefit of that dumb series of meaningless changes that they made.
Right, so this could not happen.
This would not happen. And yet here we are. We rely on Ted Cruz's idiocy to get people passed. Like, everybody needs to stop with themselves. In any case.
Yeah.
Other people that need to stop with themselves. Donald Trump talking about running for president.
Oh, my gosh.
He's not afraid.
I mean, he does this every 4 years.
Yeah, he's bless like his heart. Clockwork.
Gets himself into the news again. I've been seeing promos for the new season of Celebrity Apprentice. So this is probably...
A ploy.
This is probably just for that. A lot of doozies on that show,
yes.
By the way. A lot of real who's who of nobodies, as you may expect. But anyway, he claims that he's very strongly considering it. He's heading in January to Iowa to have some fancy Republican dinner with Terry Branstad, who's the governor there, who's awful. But, you know, he said he was asked about whether, you know, he was just toying with everyone, because every 4 years he toys with everyone. And he said, he was quoted, he said, "A lot of people think I'm just having fun with it, that I'm playing games, that I enjoy the process. And I do enjoy the process to a certain extent. But frankly, I just think that we need something very good, very fast, or we're going to be in very big trouble as a country." I don't know what very big and very fast means. That seems unclear to me as something that you would need. I don't know. What does that mean?
Well, it's not ever clear. Also, it's not clear that he would have some sort of solution for very big trouble as a country in any
respect.
I mean, it's not clear that he knows what he means either.
Right. Well, and it's also hilarious because, like, he's basically claiming that he sort of might feel inclined to run out of, you know, not because he wants to, but because, you know, because his love of country is too strong and his, you know, his need to get the country
drafted.
On the right track. Because he said, "I'd rather do what I'm doing than run for president, but I also love the country more. And I just think that unless I see somebody that's outstanding, I would be very much inclined to do it."
Mm.
Like, don't pretend like you're the only person
who can save America.
To save the country. I mean, come on.
Oh.
Like, this is the problem. This is one of many problems with Donald Trump, but it's like saying things like this is like, a thing that will make him not be able to be president.
So true.
He's just
so true.
He's far too self-important to be president. He just
yeah. Well, he's a megalomaniac. That's his one quality.
Right.
It's the main quality that he has.
Yeah,
that's
true. And that's probably a main quality that many presidents have had. Now that I think about it,
that's true. Well, that's why I think Liz Warren would be so good, because I don't think she is a megalomaniac. I think she's so little one that she doesn't want to be president at all, and actually would be very unhappy. Like, we're literally planning to ruin this woman's life in order to get a president that's not terrible. But that's why she'd be so great at it. Is because instead of it
I've
being the greatest thing...
I've never wanted to ruin
thing,
a person's life more.
Exactly. Instead of it being a great move for everyone, it would actually ruin her life, but it would be great for America.
Right.
In any case, that's the news this week.
That's it. Bicoastal Podcast, we did it.
We did. It might be the noisiest podcast you've ever heard. I've never had so many sirens and small children screaming and banging things in my life as I have right now.
I didn't hear any of that, for what it's worth.
Perfect. I hope that no one in America did either. Oh, maybe you heard that one, though. Someone just literally just, like, fired themselves into the wall on the other side of the wall that I'm on. Just to say goodbye to the podcast. But we
good
will
luck sleeping tonight.
Yeah, right. Well, they're little kids. They'll go to bed. It's fine.
Oh, okay, good.
Maybe I'll bang on the walls at 2 a.m. to even it out. We will update you. I don't know what our podcast schedule is going to be for the next couple weeks, because it's a weird couple weeks, but we'll figure it out and then we'll let you know.
Yeah.
You'll hear from us when
you
hear from us, you know.
Right.
And until then, have happy holidays, everyone. And
yes.
You know, we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.